I'm Jennifer Westaway in Boston.
I'm Robin Young at Madison Square Garden in New York.
It's Here and Now.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
That was former New York City police officer Stephen McDonald, who was shot and paralyzed in the line of duty in 1986. He led the Pledge of Allegiance to open the 2004 Republican National Convention in New York this morning. Robin Young is there. Robin, how are New Yorkers handling the grand old party and that great big protest that landed in their midst this week?
Well, you know, we're hermetically sealed here at Madison Square Garden. We come early in the morning and then we stay here along with all the delegates and the politicians. But we got the sense yesterday, obviously, that was a huge turnout. Some estimates, 500,000 people, the biggest demonstration in New York history. Obviously, some New Yorkers were put out, but much of New York is yawning, as it does at big events. I mean, they've seen so much.
Now, inside the tent, as you are at the moment, you were at the DNC as well for the Democrats. Obviously, a different message for the parties. How about the tone?
Well, it's interesting. Of course, you know, there's not as many silly hats as there are at the Democratic convention. I noticed, too, the Al Jazeera banner is up and very prominent. The Democrats felt they had to take that down, thinking that it might have some sort of statement. But no, right up there with CNN and NBC is an Al Jazeera banner. That's just sort of an image that stays with me. But as to the political tone, you know, it's early on. But Republicans are notoriously organized at these affairs. The Democrats are usually the messy ones. And this year, the Democrats were criticized by some for being so on message. It looked as if the Republicans were going to have some dissension. The log cabin Republicans, for example, very much for gay rights. Yesterday, they were collecting signatures to try to force a vote on a platform plank that would allow different differences of opinion on gay and lesbian rights. We're now hearing from the log cabin Republicans that they're going to have that fight in the media and not on the floor. We'll hear more from them later in the program. And pretty much the Republicans are presenting a unified front, despite the talk this week about the right wing of the party, the party's base, being so cut out of the, you know, the face of the convention.
Mm-hmm. And moderates at the mic, too, today.
Right,
yeah?
Right. The moderates are on the podium. Mayors Bloomberg and Giuliani, former Mayor Giuliani, will be there tonight. And Senator John McCain. Now, we're going to hear from John McCain in just a minute. But earlier today, I spoke to Ed Gillespie. He's the Republican Party chair. He's like a whirling dervish. And I caught up with him in the hall and asked him what Republicans have to do this week.
This week, I think the key for us this week is for us to talk about policies. People are going to base their vote in November on what we're doing to continue to grow the economy, to improve our public schools, continue to make health care more affordable. It's important we talk about the president's record. We're proud of that. But elections are about the future, not the past. And we need to talk about a positive agenda going forward over the next 4 years.
Well, now I'm going to ask you the question that everyone is asking you today. We just heard Senator McCain speaking, and he was called the moral center of the party by someone who was speaking to him. You know that members of your own party have also said that he is, well, not to put too fine a point on it, lipstick on the pig, that he is not really representative, and neither is Mayor Giuliani or neither is Arnold Schwarzenegger, of the right wing of the party that is really behind the party, that this is really a masquerade this week.
Well, we have Lieutenant Governor Michael Steele, Senator Elizabeth Dole, Senator Sam Brownback, Senator Rick Santorum. Interestingly enough, our keynote speaker, while a Democrat, is also a conservative, Senator Zell Miller. We have conservatives and moderates on the stage this week because we are a center-right party, and they will all be talking about the president's record, their strong support for him, and future, the policies for the future. So any party that's big enough to be the majority party, as we are happily today, that can have the governorships of California, New York, Texas, and Florida, that can control a majority of the seats in the House of Representatives and the Senate and a majority of the governorships and the White House, is going to be a party big enough to have some differences within its ranks. We accept that. We honor that. But the things that unite us are stronger than the things that separate us.
As you know, the recent polls show that President Bush is still highly likable. People like him a lot. And they like how he's waging the war in Iraq. But they do not feel that he's doing a good job in the war on terror. And he also has problems with the economy and other issues as well. How does he address that? What does he say?
Well, the president will, again, talk about policies. He'll talk about a stronger world, a more hopeful America. He will talk about, as I say, the record. He will talk about...
Can I just ask you, is the buzzword this week the record?
I don't know that it's a buzzword.
Your guy is glaring at me. Yeah. Do you have to go?
Because I gave her the last question signal about 2 minutes ago. Yeah.
Let me just say this. Yeah. In Boston, they ran from John Kerry's record. In New York, we're going to run on President Bush's record.
The buzzword is the record. Thank you.
You decide what buzzword.
Ed Gillespie. Thank you very much. Ed Gillespie, chair of the Republican National Committee, and look for the word record to be heard quite often during the week, Jennifer. As the Democrats' word was strength, I mean, there is a buzzword, and we think that's going to be it. But the conversations in the days leading up to this convention have been about the face the party is putting on, as you know, and it starts tonight with moderate Republican John McCain. Brian Lehrer of public radio station WNYC in New York spoke to Senator McCain this morning. Here's part of that interview.
You have become, in many ways, the moral center of American politics. People trust you more than Bush or Kerry, even when they disagree with you. You could sway the election with a well-chosen sentence or two. In all modesty, why do you think that is?
I hope it's because I have a long record of doing what I think is right and that people believing that I'm doing what I think is right and putting country above party. And unfortunately, in this kind of bitter partisan environment that pervades our political system, that seems to have some value.
And yet you've taken a very partisan role, if we can call it that, in this election campaign, coming out very strongly for President Bush, of course, being willing to speak at the convention tonight in prime time. How come?
Because I believe President Bush deserves re-election because of his leadership of this country following 9/11, which I think is the transcendent issue. The President and I have had disagreements on specific issues, but I believe that his leadership has proven him to be capable of leading the country for the next 4 years. And I do not believe that John Kerry would be a bad president. In fact, I'm sure he would be a good president. I just believe that George Bush has already proven his abilities to lead in this very transcendent issue.
You seem to agree with the Democrats that the Swift boat thing is a smear by the Bush campaign, like they did to you, you've said. But it seems to be really hurting John Kerry in the polls now. How do you feel about that?
I'm very angry that these ads are being run. We're reopening the wounds of the Vietnam War, which I had been working for 30 years to heal, working with John Kerry, by the way. And anybody's activities after combat, I think, is legitimate public debate, discourse, partisanship. But to question someone's performance in combat, I think, is beyond the pale, and I regret it. And today, there's probably a young American wounded or killed in Iraq. We ought to be working to see how we resolve that conflict, not trying to go back and revisit one that we cannot change the outcome of in any way, shape, or form.
But what do you say to those swing voters who you've seen the polls in the last few days have swung away from John Kerry because of this issue?
I say to them, I hope you will examine the candidates on their qualifications. I hope you will condemn those ads just as strongly as I do. This could bring into question the service of all Vietnam veterans. If you have to go back and examine the medals and the citations of one Vietnam veteran, what should keep us from doing it with all? This has enormous ramifications. And let me just add one other point. Many years ago, 18, 19, 20-year-old kids went and served in Vietnam and came home and were astonished sometimes by the treatment that they got. They thought they served honorably, yet some of their citizens portrayed them as something else. This caused problems for a lot of them. And now, are we causing these problems for them all over again by reopening this issue? I'm afraid we might.
That was member station WNYC's Brian Lehrer speaking with Senator John McCain this morning. We're joined now by Mark Leibovich in New York. He's a political reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Jennifer.
Well, we heard John McCain just refer there to the kind of tightrope that he walks. He doesn't think John Kerry would be a bad president, but he thinks George Bush is already a good one. How successful do you think John McCain has been at wearing both of those hats, a critic and a booster's hat for Bush?
So far, very successful. I mean, he is going over remarkably well among the Republican rank and file here in New York. I mean, he is being treated with a lot of the same rock star, reactions that he might be at the Democratic convention also.
Welcome everywhere he goes.
He is welcome everywhere he goes. But what's interesting is that, you know, he's obviously stirred up a great deal of resentment within the Republican Party over the last 3 or 4 years. But his loyalty has always been somewhat suspect. But I think it's clear that given the currency he has nationwide and among, you know, swing voters and then people in both parties, that he's something of a third rail, and you cross him at your peril. And I think Bush realizes this, and this is why he's taking such pains to bring McCain back into the tent.
What do you think John McCain needs to say tonight to get Bush reelected?
Well, I don't think John McCain's going to get Bush reelected. I think everyone is just trying to do their part to help out. I think, I would seriously doubt if he'll say anything about John Kerry. I think he'll probably talk quite a bit about Bush's performance after 9/11, if not specifically, you know, implicitly as far as national security and keeping the country safe. And it's less likely that people will remember the things that McCain says tonight than they will just remember the fact of him speaking in a primetime slot and actually throwing his support behind someone that, you know, he's not always been linked with in harmony.
Stepping up to the plate when they really needed him.
Right.
Can you give us a sense of how John McCain feels personally about these two men, George Bush and John Kerry? Is there a sense at all that McCain himself might be getting a little weary of John Kerry trotting out their friendship on the campaign trail?
I think he is. I mean, McCary's been doing this for about a year and you know, on the campaign trail, as did Joe Lieberman, as did Dick Gephardt. Edwards, during his primary campaign, talked a lot about the work he did with John McCain. So, you know, it's no surprise that people are going to bring his name up as in trying to sort of bask in some reflective glory. But, yeah, I think McCain has said in the last few days, he said this to me, that he's getting a tiny bit weary, at least implicitly a tiny bit weary of Kerry bringing him up so much and invoking him in ads. And so maybe his friendship has been overstated. And I also think the animosity between Bush and McCain has been softened a little bit. I think they've spent a fair amount of time together in the last few weeks. By all accounts, they've actually had a good time together. And you know, I think a lot of the wounds of 2000 have been, if not healed, smoothed over.
Okay. Thank you for this, Mark.
No problem. Thanks, Jennifer.
Mark Leibovich is a political reporter for The Washington Post. Just ahead, a day in the life of several protesters.
And later, the view from the beach. New York City may be Democratic territory, but a certain patch of Long Island boardwalk is decidedly not.
That's more coming up here and now. I'm Jennifer Westaway in Boston.
I'm Robin Young at the Republican National Convention in New York. It's here and now.
Hundreds of thousands of protesters marched past Madison Square Garden yesterday. There were a couple of hundred arrests, but the march, organized by the group United for Peace and Justice, was peaceful. WBUR reporter Fred Tice followed a group of protesters from Massachusetts to New York and has this report.
At 6:30 in the morning, the chartered bus leaves Watertown Square, where you'd normally see the destination. In front, it says, "Have a nice day." The protesters are all heading down to New York for what is supposed to be the week's biggest demonstration at the Republican National Convention.
Good morning.
Good morning.
They pick up more protesters in Arlington. Susan Falkoff says she's going down to New York because she's upset about the war in Iraq, the environment, tax cuts, which she sees as the erosion of the middle class and the erosion of civil liberties.
I feel like we're going in a direction where there's less freedom and less respect for individual rights, and that's a great concern to me.
Falkoff didn't protest in Boston at the Democratic National Convention. She says it's more important to demonstrate against the Republicans. Andre O'Neill lives in Albany. He was in Boston for a family holiday and decided he had to get to New York by hook or by crook. He, too, was at the Democratic National Convention in Boston, but didn't protest there either. He says he feels detached from the outcome of the election, but he's giving his lukewarm support to John Kerry.
I'm supporting him because I think that we need to do what we can to get Bush out of office.
Unlike many of the others on the bus who are veterans of protest marches, Lynn Tron is going to her first demonstration.
But I think that just being there, you know, providing a large presence provides a statement to show them that, you know, there's a lot of people who are upset with what's going on.
President Bush's policies on the war, the economy, and the environment are what upset her, she says.
Keep on singing loudly.
As the protesters roll into New York, they start singing.
March on Fox News Channel, Wednesday night.
Tens of thousands of protesters march peacefully past Madison Square Garden, where the Republican National Convention opens tonight. Among them is Susan Leaves of Arlington.
I think it's tremendously exciting.
With her is Masude Edmund, also of Arlington.
I am so tired, it's so hot, but I'm so happy to be here with all these people who are against George Bush. We really like to see him gone.
Edmund finds the accommodations for protests in New York better than those in Boston during the Democratic National Convention.
The thing we didn't like about Boston, they had a cage for us, and we were not allowed to have a march on the streets. So we boycotted the cage, although they call it free speech zone. So we really boycotted it. We didn't show up there. But here, at least we are able to march, and that's why I'm so excited.
George Cabaccio of Arlington says the march should have been allowed to culminate in a rally in Central Park.
750,000 people could attend a Paul Simon concert, but marchers here exercising their right as an American can't go to Central Park.
After a break for a picnic of stuffed grape leaves in Union Square, the band of Bostonians heads off on the subway to Central Park anyway. By the time Masude Edmund gets to the park, she finds the crowd rather small. Police are there in force, and they're allowing the protesters to gather despite the ban.
This is like 1/8, 1/10 of the crowd we saw on the street. I mean, they did a good job scattering us.
George Cabaccio is disappointed that there are no speeches.
It's lovely, but we need something more, some way to bring the message together, some way to sort of unite, integrate, solidify what it is that we're about, why we're here today, and what you're trying to communicate to the Republicans and to the country at large.
Cabaccio and his fellow protesters settle on the grass to enjoy the sunshine for a few minutes before they have to look for their bus back to Boston.
That was WBUR reporter Fred Tice. Robin Young at Madison Square Garden, you were telling us a moment ago that you feel rather hermetically sealed in there, but what was it like on the way into the center today? Was there a sign of protest?
We didn't see any this morning, of course. Again, you know, we didn't see much of anything very early this morning. We know that there are some protests scheduled for today. Still We Rise, rather, is having a protest this afternoon. There's one scheduled at 7 p.m. That's at March for Our Lives. That's another group, Poor People's Economic Human Rights. There are protests scheduled throughout the week. You know, it's been decades since these things were spontaneous.
Mm-hmm.
The big day is expected to be Thursday. President Bush, of course, speaking Thursday night. They're calling it Vigil for the Fallen. This is United for Peace and Justice, the group that organized the huge march yesterday, has sent out an agenda of the organized marches. And on Thursday's Vigil for the Fallen is supposed to have many veterans, including some recently returned from Iraq, Gold Star parents, other military families, 9/11 families, those, as they put it, who are concerned for the fallen. Tuesday, tomorrow, there's going to be a day of nonviolent civil disobedience and direct action, calling for, you peaceful stages of resistance, and that should have some images, if nothing else, some sort of street theater tomorrow. But it's part of the theater of political protest, and it's expected to go on all week.
And theater is a good word to use, because it is something of a protest for the cameras and microphones, is it? It doesn't sound like the delegates would be aware any of this was going on outside.
Well, actually, there was, they protested as the delegates went to many Broadway shows. They were standing at the protesters were standing at the entrance to some of the programs. And so they are also confronting delegates and leaders where they are this week. And I should say, we were in the middle of the huge march yesterday. As luck would have it, our hotel was smack in the middle of it.
And only a reporter would think that was lucky, Robin.
Some of the images were striking. The thousand coffins from the group thousandcoffins.com as they were carried down 7th Avenue. That was quite an image. But the debate is raging as to whether or not, what the effect of this is going to be. Many say that those swing voters out mainly in the Midwest look at these images and say, what party is that? And others might say, 500,000 people can't be wrong.
Yeah. Who do I really swing when I protest this strongly?
Exactly.
Robin Young joining us from the Republican National Convention. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Jennifer Westaway in Boston.
I'm Robin Young at the Republican National Convention in New York. It's here and now.
One key Republican not in New York today is President Bush. He's campaigning in two key swing states, New Hampshire and Michigan. Recent polls show the president squeaking ahead in several battleground states like Ohio, Wisconsin, and Missouri. And a new USA Today CNN Gallup poll shows the president and Senator Kerry tied in Pennsylvania. The economy still tops the list of voter concerns, but so does the war in Iraq. And here's what President Bush had to say on NBC's Today show this morning about the war on terror.
I don't think you can win it, but I think you can create conditions so that those who use terror as a tool are less acceptable in parts of the world. Let's put it that way.
Joining us on the line to talk about the issues at play for the fall vote, especially in those key swing states, are David Yepsen, political columnist for the Des Moines Register in Iowa. Hi, David.
Hi.
And Ron Harris, a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in Missouri. Hello, Ron.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. David, if I can start with you, do you agree with that USA Today's read of the race that Iowa's tending Democratic right now? It's looking like they're giving almost a 6-point lead to John Kerry.
It is very close. I've seen some polling that shows Bush up a couple points. Most polling shows Kerry up a couple points. The Democrats have carried this state in every election since 1984. I would have to say this state is leaning Kerry at this point.
But still very much in flux.
Oh, yeah. And yeah. For example, George Bush is going to be in this state twice in the coming week. He's here tomorrow, and then he's here on Friday. We can never recall a time when a sitting president has been in this state twice in the same week.
Ron, how about you? Where does Missouri stand? How significant would a small lead for George Bush be for him there at this point in time?
Well, he took Missouri in 2000 by just a very small number of votes, only 80,000 votes out of almost two and a half million cast. And he does have a small lead here. But one of the things about some of the polls, they factored in Nader, and Nader pulled 3% of the vote, but Nader's not on the ballot this year. Yeah, so the LA Times poll, for instance, gave Nader 3% of the vote. Bush 46%, Kerry 42%, but and Nader 3%, but Nader's not on the he will not be on the ballot this year.
That's shades of voters who vote for dead people.
There you go.
Well, since you bring it up, I did want to talk about the Nader factor this time around, because in some of the swing states he is on the ballot and he is getting. It's small. It's 2-6%. But I'd like to go back to you, David. Is that enough to pull from John Kerry?
Ralph Nader is on the ballot in Iowa,
uh-huh.
And I don't expect him to be that much of a factor. I know of no one who thinks he is going to get nearly the vote he got last time in this state. He got about 2%, which Gore carried Iowa in 2000. So it was a bit of a drag on Gore, but it didn't deny him the state. I just think the Democrats and the left, even the most pure ones, are unhappy with Kerry for one reason or another, primarily that he's not strong enough against the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
But one of them told me just the other night that he's going to hold his nose and vote for Kerry. I don't think Nader is going to be a big factor.
David, what about the really big states at play here, states like Pennsylvania and Florida, where they're considered must wins for either or both candidates? Where do you think they're trending at this point?
They're toss-ups. You can look at a poll day to day, and I would be very, really hesitant to make projections beyond that. They're a snapshot. We're going to have a convention this week. Bush will get some kind of bounce, a point or two or three out of this, and then we focus on the debates. This election is going to be decided in Florida, Pennsylvania, Missouri, Iowa, by probably less than 10% of the electorate. People who are genuinely undecided, who have not decided what they're going to do,
mm-hmm.
Some untoward events like a terrorist attack. I think that could move voters one way or another off of current preferences. So it's just too early to answer that question of how some state is trending.
Right.
And, you know, I think Dave is really right in that it's going to be really, really tight, particularly here in Missouri. What's strange is how the war is playing and not playing in terms of this election. Particularly in places like Missouri and particularly in some of those battleground states. It's strange in that there's a lot of coverage about the war, but in some ways there's not – people don't feel an impact of the war. They don't feel it personally because it's hitting mostly those small towns. I did a story about this not too long ago that most of the people who are fighting the war and most of the people who are dying in the war, at least a large percent, 46% of them, come from small towns.
Mm-hmm.
About 5,000 population. Well, when those people die, when those people are killed, those headlines don't hit in St. Louis. They don't hit in Kansas City. They hit in that little small town. And a lot of those things, the war is not resonating the way that a lot of people think it is.
How about the effect that the different electoral map will have on 2004? I'm thinking about the number of electoral college votes, which are widely believed to favor the Republicans.
Well, what happened after the census was the country reallocated electoral votes. And so if George Bush carries the same states today that he carried in 2000, he would win by about 8 to 10 more electoral votes. But having said that, you know, there are other demographic factors at work. If John Kerry gets the same percentage of minority and Latino vote that Al Gore got, he'll win by several million votes because there are that many more new voters in the electorate. That's one of the reasons George Bush is spending so much time whipping up his base of evangelicals, religious fundamentalists, social conservatives. There were about 3 million of them who did not vote in 2000. He needs to offset Kerry's demographic gains with some demographic gains of his own.
Mm-hmm.
So this election really in many ways comes down to a turnout operation. You know, we talk about organizations in politics and they don't mean a whole lot. They don't. They only can make a difference of a point or two. But in many of these states we're talking about, both of our states, the turnout operation, the boring shoe leather phone bank kind of thing that gets the last voter to the polls, that could tip the balance.
David, but I'd like to ask David a question. I mean, David, I think you got a really good point. But looking at this convention, they're shying away from exactly those people you're talking about.
Well, that's right. Both political conventions are masquerade balls where the party sort of sort of dresses up in the other party's costumes. I mean, look at all the generals and military talk that we had coming out of the Democrats. So it's natural that Republicans are going to highlight their more moderate members, tone down some of the edges, you know, in an effort to try to reach some of these undecided voters.
In other words, the plank, I mean, the platform that they're going to bring forward, that will energize the base.
I think the base is very happy with the platform. That's right.
Yes, exactly. I see.
Okay. Thank you both for joining us today.
Okay. All
right. Ron Harris is a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in Missouri, and David Yepsen is political columnist for the Des Moines Register in Iowa. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
One of the hotly contested planks in the Republican platform is the issue of gay marriage. Today, Ralph Reed, former director of the Christian Coalition and now an advisor to the Bush-Cheney reelection campaign, told me that he believes the president's call for a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage is the right one.
The president believes that marriage should be between a man and a woman, and in a recent New York Times CBS poll, 60% of the American people agreed. So the president has a mainstream position supported by the majority of the American people.
But a group of Republicans supporting gay rights has another opinion. Patrick Guerrero is executive director of the Log Cabin Republicans. Patrick's on the line. And, Patrick, we understand that yesterday members of your group were trying to gather signatures to get a floor vote on a new platform plank that would say Republicans respected differences of opinion on gay and lesbian rights. What happened with that attempt to get votes?
We actually made a decision overnight to take this issue to a greater audience, which is launching a television ad this morning here in New York that basically calls on the party to make a choice about whether it's the party of Ronald Reagan and George Pataki, Mayor Giuliani, Bill Weld, and those voices of inclusion, or an exclusionary party of Jerry Falwell and Rick Santorum. The reality is, and something Ralph Reed didn't mention, is that the party platform goes further than making a case for a constitutional amendment, which is bad enough. The party platform was hijacked by Ralph Reed and the radical right, and it includes language that would deny domestic partnership and civil unions, and that goes against the majority of Americans, even against almost half of the delegates here at the convention who support civil unions, but maybe don't support gay marriage yet.
But, Patrick, I'm curious as to how you fared. You know, you need a majority of delegates in six states to sign a petition calling for a vote on a plank in order for it to reach the floor and possibly a floor fight. How close did you get?
The actual most delegates were just arriving to New York yesterday and this morning, and the Republican Party was strategic in deciding to have a voice vote on the platform only a few minutes from now. Mm-hmm. And so the reality was we turned to our friends. There will be folks who speak out against it. There's a lot of mainstream groups that are outraged at the language regarding not only gay and lesbian issues, but choice, stem cell research, and other issues where there is not a message of inclusion. And the Republican Party better hope that most of the American people don't read this platform. Most don't. It is a out of mainstream, extremely radical document written by the far right.
Patrick, we only have a minute left, and so you're saying you ran out of time, you know, to do this. But some would say, Patrick Guerrero, you mentioned all of those issues. Many people see that those are in the planks and that the people at the podium don't represent the plank. And many people would want to ask of you, why are you a Republican?
Our membership, which is growing every day, supports a strong and confident foreign policy, limited government. We support free trade. We even support family values. And it's going to take courageous gay and lesbian Americans and our friends to work within the Republican Party. There's no way to pass civil rights legislation in this country without both the Republicans and Democrats. And we celebrated yesterday with Governor Pataki, Michael Bloomberg, and so many other governors from Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right, they came and saw you, yes.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And there's room in this party. The future is on our side. We have a way to go. We launched this ad, which people can view at www.logcabin.org today, and most of the delegates are going to have to face the question of whether we're the party of exclusion or the party of tolerance. And it's not fair for Karl Rove to put our friends up in prime time while letting the radical right hijack the platform and policy agenda of the GOP.
Patrick, thanks for speaking with us. I'm afraid that's all the time we have.
Have a great day.
Patrick Guerrero is executive director of the Log Cabin Republicans and spoke to us here in New York City. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now.
I'm Jennifer Westaway in Boston.
I'm Robin Young in New York.
It's Here and Now.
Less than an hour from New York City, you'll find one of the most popular state parks in the country. In fact, more people visit Jones Beach every year than Yellowstone and Yosemite combined.
Excuse me, I wonder, is there a castle under development here, and can you tell me your plans for it? What do you plan your castle to look like?
No, we're not really trying to dig a castle. We're looking for animals.
What kind?
There are like little fish, and there are shells that move and dig underground.
You mean clams?
Yeah, you see clams.
Jones Beach is a place rich in old traditions, but also a place to find out what New Yorkers are thinking today. It's actually several beaches spread over 2,500 acres and 6.5 miles on the south shore of Long Island. New York families and the legendary Jones Beach lifeguards have been coming here for generations.
And how have you seen Jones Beach change over the 27 years you've been here?
I don't think it's really changed that much. The water's much cleaner.
Can you describe what a special place this is for people? You're smiling.
You spend your time looking out over the ocean, contemplating where you want your life to go, what direction you're trying to take it. You know, definitely like a yoga type of experience, you know. So.
And yet, just a few miles away from us, 250,000 people are gathering in the streets of New York. And is that at all on your mind, anything that's going on in the city right now?
It's kind of interesting you say that. Like somebody yesterday put a package under the boat. And a patron came up, and they were uneasy about it, and we called the police, you know, and so that's a reflection of what's going on in Manhattan. You know.
But in other ways, Jones Beach is a place frozen in time, created by a man whose power would be the envy of the politicians meeting in Manhattan. Robert Moses was never elected to office, but was one of the most powerful people ever in New York government, and many say did more than anyone to influence, for better and worse, the American urban landscape.
People come from all over, for Jones Beach is famous for offering more facilities than any private resort could hope to, and everyone is welcome here. Lockers and bath cabins are rented for a modest fee. Use of the beach itself and most recreation areas are free.
From the 30s through the 50s, Robert Moses held different jobs in New York. At one point, he directed a quarter of the federal construction dollars to the city and had 80,000 people working for him. He built beautiful bridges, but was vilified for displacing tens of thousands of people from their homes. He okayed the destruction of the beautiful old Penn Station to make way for Madison Square Garden, site of this week's convention. But he also had a dream of an American Riviera. And yesterday we walked the boardwalk at Jones Beach with historian John Norback to hear more about it.
Jones Beach officially opened August 4th, 1929. It cost originally $15 million to construct, and it was probably the finest public facility ever developed in the last century. This real estate is priceless. It hasn't been developed thanks to the foresight and vision of Robert Moses, the master builder, who envisioned building the finest buildings for the public, for the everyman to come visit and enjoy the seaside. He used everything that would be inconceivable in a public works project, including Barbizon brick for the buildings, Ohio sandstone, which are an enormous undertaking and also very expensive to build.
He wanted it to feel as if you were on a cruise.
Absolutely. It incorporates the funnel cans that disguise trash receptacles. We have deck game, shuffleboard. It's definitely an Art Deco design, and you know, keep in mind that it was developed in the 20s and the 30s, and it's similar in lines and appearance to the Chrysler Building in Manhattan.
The boardwalk is actually more like a deck. I mean, it's huge, it's wide, and the railing that went along, I think I remember when I was a child, it was actually mahogany for miles. I understood there was one guy whose job it was to start at one end and go to the other and revarnish it, and that's all he did for a long time.
Actually, we had a crew of about 14 that worked the whole spring to do that.
John, I understand that there are people who have been coming here for decades every weekend. They dissect what's going on in the world from their perches. What are they called?
They're called concretions. They come here every day. They're our own sidewalk superintendents, and they've been here for decades.
Excuse me, I hate to break up this confab, but I wondered, what do you talk about?
What do we talk about? Yeah. We talk about every problem in the world we solve here. And I'm the only Republican here. Everybody else is a liberal Democrat. Oh, Joe's a Republican. I'm a Bush conservative. We got these other old Kerry liberals here.
Oh boy, is Kerry liberal over here?
I was a Democrat all my life up to this year until Kerry came along.
And what? Why? What's your concern there?
He flip flops. And I don't like voting for billionaires. And I don't use Heinz ketchup.
Well, wait a minute. Voting for billionaires, isn't Mr. Bush? From
give him another 4 years, then he'll be a billionaire. We all have that ambition to be a billionaire, so that's why we vote that way. We don't want a liberal operation that we're never going to be. We're just going to be one of the group. We all have that internal ambition that we're going to succeed.
And you think President Bush will help you more in that end?
President Bush makes me feel secure, let me put it that way.
Yeah, the Republicans are meeting, as you know, a couple miles away in Manhattan. What would you want to hear from them?
They're politicians. What are you going to hear from them? What are they going to do for me?
You know, I'm interested. You have your pal over here. He was a Democrat up until recently. New Yorkers are, by and large, registered Democrats. Have you seen them change?
Well, I'd say New York's registered. New York City is Democratic. The rest of the state's Republican.
Do the conversations ever get heated here, or
No. Well, again, certain people, but still, we're friends, and politics won't break us up. But
well, anything else you talk about? I mean, do you have concerns about when the war in Iraq is going to end, the economy, anything else?
We talk about all that stuff, but there's nothing we can do about it. We just talk about it. That's all. Yeah. We could stop the war in Iraq. It's inevitable. We can't stop the economy. Supposedly, if you read the paper, the economy is improving. I can't see it because all my investments are going down. But
what would you want to hear from the Republicans this week about the economy?
What can I tell you? Like Kerry says, we're going to make 10 million jobs in 4 years. It's impossible. How could he do that? Well, if they say we're going to close Jones Beach down, then there's a revolution. Then we're going to take up arms and wherever we have to go, we'll go. That's all I can say.
You've been at the beach, I'm guessing, almost since its inception. I mean, maybe.
I started coming here as a 4-year-old baby. My mother used to take me here. There were ropes out in the water. And you guys don't remember that. They had poles with ropes. You used to hang on the ropes and the waves used to hit them.
I was a lifeguard here in 39.
Wow.
You know, it takes you back in time. If you just close your eyes, you're back there.
Jones Beach is its most magical at night. This weekend, under a full moon, a country band played in the shell by the ocean. Hundreds watched while dozens danced. Others strolled the wide boardwalk.
I remember the night Hamilton sang you all.
The sounds of the group Yes floated on the wind from the amphitheater. 20 and 30-somethings played on 8 beach volleyball courts. There were families playing miniature golf, couples on the shuffleboards. While you're waiting for the ladies' pucks or whatever they are to come down, can you describe this night for somebody who doesn't get it, how beautiful a beach can be?
It's very romantic. You're out with your wife. I'm Spanish, so it's like romantic to me, I mean.
As we reluctantly left Jones Beach to head back to the city, we came across several generations of one family, the women all in headscarves, all enjoying a late-night picnic dinner under the full moon.
Just right for the summer. It's perfect.
I mean, you're under a full moon. You've got a band shell down there. You've got the ocean over there.
The golf course and the boardwalk, and you can still roll around in the sand over here. It's great.
I'm wondering, too, are you taking refuge from the city and the Republican convention?
That's exactly what we're doing. That's exactly what we're doing. Get away from all that. We ignore it and pretty much escape all that headache and all the commotion and all that.
A brief respite, but now it's back to work. Our trip to Jones Beach was produced by April Peavy.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Ian Hughes. Our web producer is Zach Christo. Our newscast producer is Jeremy Hobson.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Jennifer Westaway.
I'm Robin Young in New York.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.